Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the 465th edition of the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. Give you American perspective, our clubs, leagues, players, national team, and other fabulous moments. You get your daily reading from me and other writers over at Once a Metro and the rest of the SB Nation family of soccer websites. Chat room is open. Come on in. Discuss amongst yourselves if you like. You have a question for me, I'm trying to answer the best of my ability. As we continue to honor and celebrate 25 years of Major League Soccer, it's not just the players that makes this league special. It's not just the voices that enunciate those special moments in this league. But, of course, it's also the writers that cover this sport, that covered this league from its beginnings up till now, a quarter century of MLS in the books. Join me, of course. He is a colleague of mine. I am always grateful to share the same press box with this gentleman because this man has done so much writing about the game of American soccer. The one and the only Michael Lewis joins me, who has been a part of so many publications, the New York Daily News, Big Apple Soccer, Front Row Soccer now, and of course, New York Newsday. Michael, thank you for coming on. Good evening. I hope you and Joyce are doing well and are staying safe through this whole pandemic situation.
Well, thank you very much for the kind words, first of all. And yes, Joy and I are as safe as we can be. I think we're probably all going a little crazy and insane just being through this whole process. We all do it in our own unique way. But it's great to be on, and hopefully there'll be some soccer sports. Hopefully the right decisions will be made and the right safety decisions will be made as well.
Before we even talk about you, the news coming through The Athletic with Sam Steckel and Paul Tenorio about, you know, how MLS is trying to, I guess, fast track to get this Orlando tournament underway, and now all of a sudden there seems to be a threat of a lockout from the league because the players decide to do a counter proposal. What's your opinion about this, and do you think this could hurt the game if this lockout does seem to happen, and it sounds like it might happen quickly?
Yeah, after all that work behind the scenes, and I don't know exactly how many man hours it has gone into both sides trying to get a solution, it would be ironic and sad, and probably have a few other adjectives. They're all not four-letter words. Don't worry about that. For the game, it'll definitely hurt the game this year. I think it eventually bounced back, but it'll be, if there is a lockout, it will be a black eye for MLS. I did see what was said on Twitter that the league is about, all the league cares about is money, and heck, I've known that for years. It's I think money first, and then comes soccer. And I understand
that's very
that.
True,
don't get me
because...
wrong. I understand money makes the world go round, and I'm stealing it from some movie or some song. But money is important, but I think there's got to be some sort of a balance. I don't have an answer to it because I don't know the exact facts on either side, but there's got to be a balance. Listen, look what's happening to Major League Baseball in a similar way. The players and the owners are not on the same page. The last time I looked, things can change. Things have been so fluid in the last 3 months. But I guess we're just going to have to wait and see if one side blinks, or maybe we don't have a tournament or a season this year.
Well, let's hope there will be some form of a season. That's what I'm hoping for, and we'll just have to wait and see what's going to happen, I guess, in the next 24 hours. It might be shorter than that. We'll have to wait and see. Michael, every single time I get to Red Bull Arena or if I get to Yankee Stadium for either a Red Bulls match or New York City FC match, you're always there. You're ready to go, whether it's by pen and paper, typewriter, I apologize for throwing that in there, or by laptop. you have been, in my mind, you have been one of the cornerstones of, you know, writing about this game. Obviously, you know, there's Stephen Goff in Washington, D.C. There's Grant Wall, who has been a part of Sports Illustrated for a long, long time until what recently happened to him. And, you know, what has it been about this sport that got you involved to writing about it and covering, you know, not just Major League Soccer, but everything else that goes on club-wise and for the U.S. men's and women's national teams?
Well, first of all, again, thank you very much for those kind words. Boy, I'll take you back on my time machine to 1974 and how I got started in soccer. I was at the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. I was 21 years old, and apparently the sports editor there, Larry Grable, liked my work that I was doing in high schools. That's the traditional way of starting in many soccer, in many newspapers, and probably the traditional way back in the day. You know, when you're fresh out of college, you start in high schools. And to me, I was delighted to do that, no problem at all. But they wanted to give me some more responsibility, and there was a major league team in that city called the Rochester Lancers, who at the time did not have the best of reputations. They seemed to have more problems and headaches off the field than games on it. And if there was one sport or one team I didn't want to cover at the time, was soccer and the Lancers. I'm going to give you, by the way, this is my long-winded answer, so this might take up for the next 30 minutes. No, seriously. And for one reason why I didn't want to cover soccer is I was ignorant in it. And I know, say the jokes now. There are some coaches and players and fans that claim that I'm still ignorant in it. But I really did not know the game. And the worst thing to do is embarrass yourself in front of thousands of people on a daily basis. Of course, the soccer gods or the sports writing gods love to play tricks on all of us. And it was a January, snowy night, cold snowy night in Rochester. When isn't there a cold snowy night in January in Rochester? I was called over to the assistant sports editor's desk of Bill Parker, and he had like this bunch of files on it, and he starts explaining to me about the Rochester Lancers. And I'm thinking, no, this is my worst nightmare. I don't want to know from them. And I'm getting the idea that, I'm getting assigned that beat. And I don't remember exactly what he said, but I remember he pushed the files toward me, and I'm standing in front of him. And, you know, he says, congratulations, you're covering your first major league professional team. And all I wanted to do is push it back toward him, no thank you. And the reason is because I didn't do it, I should say, is because I was still under probation there. We had every new signee at the Democrat and Chronicle, owned by Gannett at the time, had to go over a full year's probation, and I was there for, 6 months. And I still wanted to be a sports writer. And then I just figured, worst things could happen. I might not have a job. And I figured, hey, what the heck? I'm only going to cover this for 2 years, and I'll be out of it. There was something about the sport that enticed me. I mean, the learning curve was ridiculous. There was no soccer on TV. The closest thing we had to it actually was Soccer Made in Germany, and that was a week later after a German, Bayern Munich generally, a game was shown in Germany, and we'd see it here on the local public broadcasting station. There were a few books, a handful of soccer publications. I tried to do as much homework as I could. The former Lancers beat writer, who became an assistant editor at the paper, he helped me out. Former Lancers writer who wasn't at the paper anymore, Alex Loy, he helped me out. The team, public relations director, Jim Paglia, who, by the way, wound up being the Chicago venue World Cup director in 1994, yes, for that World Cup. He helped me out. And I thought it was pretty cool after a while. I'm getting a chance to meet players from around the world and learning cultures, history, that sort of thing. So that's part one. I don't want to take up the rest of the hour with that answer, but if you ask me more questions, I might have to answer it indirectly.
That's fine. That's okay, because it's really interesting to hear how you got started. And, of course, being a Rochester native, those Lancers, I believe that was the NASL, North American Soccer League, that they were a part of back then?
Yes, they were. They not only played in the same league as the Cosmos, they played in the same division as them. And I think that was part of, you know, it wasn't like one day I said, I love soccer. It was a slow buildup. And let's face it, in those days, the Cosmos would come to town not once but twice a year in the mid-70s. So I got a chance to see Pelé play a lot. Got a chance to visit New York City, watch him play at Giant Stadium, watched him play in Toronto at CNE Stadium, which is where, by the way, BMO Field stands today. Small world, huh? Slowly but surely, you know, I started to take in the game. And let's face it, Pelé, the soccer boom, the Cosmos going crazy, attendance rising, some of the greatest players in the world coming over here, Cruyff, Beckenbauer, Carlos Alberto, you have Canalia with the Cosmos. And, you know, I thought this was going to be a sport for the future, and I wasn't going to beg off the beat. And, you know, all of a sudden I was understanding the game more. I was hardly an expert then, but there was something about the game. Nori Sabunku, one of the co-owners of the Lancers, told me something in 1977. Once you get soccer in your blood, you can't get it out of yourself. And I thought, well, what a hooky thing that is that he said. And, well, he's absolutely right. And I think for a lot of us, it's not just for me, but there's just something about the game that is enticing. And I think it's because it's so difficult to score a goal. Yes, I struggled on some of my early stories, especially with the games that were 1-0 or, heaven forbid, scoreless draws. But there's something special about scoring a goal in soccer, because it is so difficult to put into the opposition's net.
It really is. I mean, sometimes I find it interesting how you watch some of these great players back in the day. How does Pelé do it all the time? How does Maradona do it all the time? You know, if you want to talk about, I guess, you know, Ryan Giggs or Wayne Rooney, how Messi does it with ease. It just sometimes you see these players and they have the ball at their feet and you wonder, how can they move it up so quickly and then they can just put it into the back of the net with so much accuracy? It's unbelievable.
I think it's a combination of things. I'm no expert at this. But I think, first of all, they are born with God-given talents. Not that they know about it immediately, but they work and train hard. You know, it's not like Pelé went out the first day and did bicycle kicks. I think he just played with his friends and started to develop. And you could say that about Messi, Ronaldo, or whoever has been a great player. Beckenbauer was never one to be fancy, but he had this incredible computer in his brain that he could check out like every possible passing lane and what was the safest and what was the riskiest, depending on the situation. I wish I would have that brain in general, let alone for soccer. And everyone has these unique abilities that, again, were honed over a series of years while growing up. I enjoy watching magic happen on the field. I remember one time, this is at the old Giant Stadium, demolished Giant Stadium now, the Red Bulls, I think probably were the Metro Stars at the time, were playing the Columbus Crew and Brian Mesonoff scored this incredible goal. And the entire front row of the press box, we just, you know, even though it was for the opposing team, the visiting team, we the superlatives that were coming out of our mouths said it all. And I think, you know, if one thing that I want to see when I go to a game, besides a good game, is magic, a special moment. I know, you know, 90 minutes of beautiful soccer, it's not going to happen. Games are going to have hills and valleys, lulls. Parts of it might put you to sleep. But is there going to be at least one special moment in the game, hopefully a few more, that you're going to remember the game about? John Wolniak, when he scored against Columbus in 2003 on that 53-yard pass from Amado Guevara. It was a scoreless draw in overtime, extra time, and he put it away. And I think every one of the writers in the press box that night, we wrote about the goal. I mean, who cares about the rest of the game? That was scintillating. I probably use that word in my story. I don't use that word too often. It's got to be something special. But I'm going to remember that game for that obvious reason, because that moment was so special. Danny Sapero scoring, a goalkeeper scoring off of a free kick. I couldn't believe what I had seen. I had to see it again on instant replay to make sure I had seen this reality, because I had never seen a goalkeeper score from the run of play like that. Yeah, I've seen goalkeepers coming up on corner kicks late in the match, convert penalty kicks, shootouts, that sort of thing. But those are the moments I live for. Not enough of them, but I still live for them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know what you're talking about. I call it the 55-yard bomb by Amado Guevara, and then John Wolniak with that magical volley just absolutely roofing the net. And if you go on slow motion on the tape, John Bush has this whimsical look on his face like, how in the hell did this go in?
You know, yeah, I didn't even notice that. I'm going to have to look at the video when I get off the air to see that look. Sometimes we never look at the goalkeeper's expression after a goal, which would be, I think, interesting to see, because while we're watching the celebration, or sometimes we're, when I say we, it's the fans, the media, everyone else, we're looking for the instant replay so we could see exactly what happened, because sometimes these things happen so quickly. And thank God for instant replay these days, because when I started way back in the Stone Age, there was very little NASL on TV until the Cosmos obviously were on Channel 9, WOR in New York, but there was nothing in the Lancers press box, and you had to really be focused on the game. You didn't want to miss anything at all, because you wanted to get it right, no matter who scored.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. You want to make sure you get everything correctly, and you don't want to find a way to do it incorrectly or get the wrong information. When the World Cup came in 1994, how fun was it to, watch this world celebration of sports be in our own backyard? And, you know, were you following the U.S. men's national team religiously at the same time?
I was working for the New York Daily News at the time as their soccer columnist / writer. And I, whatever assignment they gave me, I took. And they did not have me cover the U.S. team until later on. They had a couple of staff writers do it, and that's their want. I understand that. Saying that, I got a chance to cover 16 or 17 games. I could be off by one or two on that. I have to double check that. Bouncing around the country, first on the East Coast, then in the Midwest, and then eventually on the West Coast. It was crazy. There was one day I was literally in three cities in one day. I've never done anything like that. I started out in Chicago, flew to Dallas to cover a quarterfinal game between Brazil and the Netherlands. Great game, 3-2, won by Brazil. And then wound up in Los Angeles on the West Coast, but within the same day. And I'm glad I did it at that age. I don't know how much, if I could put up with 17 games on all the airline flights that I did within, what, a 30-31 day period today. I don't know if I could pull that off. Forget about the fact how difficult it is now with the COVID pandemic to fly, but in terms of recovering after a flight, when you get older, it takes a lot more energy out of you. Saying that, answering your question, I had a ball. I mean, covering Bulgaria, covering Germany and Lothar Matthäus. Little did I know that he was going to be playing for the Metro Stars in 5 or 6 years from there, and interviewing him one-on-one in a mixed zone press conference. And actually, I liked him because his answers were very straightforward and really good. I felt like he was telling the truth. When he was with the Metro Stars, he was the center of several controversies. And eventually I did catch up to the U.S. team in the round of 16, is it? Yeah, mm-hmm. Against Brazil. Tab Ramos, you know, gets elbowed in the face. Was it Leonardo gets thrown out of the game? And the U.S. doesn't attack very well under head coach Bora Milutinovic, and they lose to Brazil 1-0. I think Bora, I know he was trying to keep it close, but you know something, even if you've got a one-man advantage on a team, a talented team like Brazil, a team like Brazil that was going to win the World Cup, I think you've got to just throw all caution to the wind at one time or another in the second half and try to get that equalizer.
Michael, if I can ask you this question. I'm sorry. Yeah. Please continue. Well, I want to ask this question. I've had on Eric Winalda on this show. I've had Marcelo Balboa, Paul Caligiuri, Tony Meola. I've also had on Alexi Lalas last week. In your mind, if Tab Ramos does not get elbowed hard into his head by Leonardo, because the way that he was playing in that match, seeing the highlights, to me, you know, being of Uruguayan descent, I mean, that's like an equalizer to an entire Brazilian side. If Tab Ramos does not get elbowed in the head and the U.S. still has him on the pitch, do you think it's an upset special against Brazil?
I'm not certain it would be. I'm not saying it wouldn't be either. That's a tough question. I think it would definitely help even things up. I still think Tab would have probably gotten kicked the you-know-what out of him by someone else later on in the game. But Tab Ramos, well, to me, was the most talented U.S. player over his entire career. And unfortunately, near the end, he had some knee injuries. But, man, he could do things. Not only did he have the natural talent, but he had a great soccer mind. And I could tell when I talked to him how his soccer IQ is so high. He's probably forgotten more about the sport than you and I will ever know together. But going back to that, I think I would have loved to have seen the game played out with him in it. I think it would have been perhaps a different result. Maybe the U.S. would have gotten the goal because of his creativity. It's just a missed opportunity there, and I hate to throw a coach under the bus before, but I'll throw Bora under the bus because, again, I don't think he pushed enough. I'm not certain if the U.S. Could pull off an upset that day. As talented a player as Tab is, Brazil had a special team at that time, and they were a better team. They did manage to get past the U.S. Saying all that, I would have loved to have seen an upset. No doubt about it. No doubt about it.
Yeah.
And if that was the case, maybe Italy would be champions.
Who knows? Maybe we'll see. Who knows? We can always play the what-if game. Sometimes I like to play the what-if game, but you know, back in 2002, it's if only Hugh Dallas would have called for the penalty. You know, maybe it'd be 1-1 against Germany, and then maybe it goes an extra time. Who knows? But I've always felt that I this is what I always tell people. I'm not saying the U.S. would have beaten the Germans, but I've always felt that if the referee from Scotland and Hugh Dallas, if he would have just blown his whistle and point to the spot to say you're getting a penalty, at least they deserved a penalty kick chance. That's all I can tell you.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you on that, no doubt. You know, that was a tough game, no doubt about it. By the way, and there was that, you know, by the way, Hugh Dallas refereed, worked the middle of the U.S.-Tunisia game at the 1996 Olympics, and he actually yellow-carded a Tunisian player twice and didn't realize it. And we noticed it in the press box, and eventually the message got down to the fourth official, and the fourth official told Dallas, and then he threw the guy out. And I, after that, even though the U.S. won 2-0, that's an egregious error, and I would have, if I was FIFA, I would have made sure Mr. Dallas would have not refereed a big-time game after that. You don't make mistakes like that and then get a chance to officiate in the World Cup. Sorry. That level.
And there
I'm not
it
saying
is,
not
ladies
never
and gentlemen.
Again.
No, but I agree with you. I agree with you. There it is, ladies and gentlemen, from the man himself, Michael Lewis. Hugh Dallas is a marked man on U.S. soil. He does not deserve to referee, even though he's probably not refereeing international matches anymore. Still, though, that man did not deserve to officiate USA-Germany in the quarterfinals of the 2002 World Cup. So all I can say is that that is a marked man, regardless if he wears a kilt or not. Anyway, Major League Soccer finally comes into the picture in 1996. Were you at the Palladium when they announced the team names and the kits of those representing those teams that were signed to those teams?
Yes, I was. I don't remember the whole thing because there were probably more important games to remember. But I did remember. I think was Lexi there? I think, and I think Tab might have been there too. I'm almost, you know, it's now that you're jogging my memory. Yeah, now it's starting to come back to me. It's funny because I have a story. An original story from 1994 when they announced the teams, and there was supposed to be a team on Long Island, Mitchell Athletic Complex, where the Cosmos play right now, but that team never came to fruition, and obviously there was the Metro Stars. But it was exciting seeing professional soccer come back to life. First division professional soccer, because there was professional soccer around, but nothing like the level of MLS. I remember when the NASL went out of business after the 1984 season, and I think a lot of us mourned that. And when the U.S. got knocked out of World Cup qualifying contention by Costa Rica in 1985, it started the dark ages of soccer in this country, when people complain that, oh, look what happened in 2017. The U.S. didn't qualify for the World Cup, and that was a horrible result for the USA, no doubt about it. But there was so much soccer going on in this country, the sport wasn't going to die. 1985, we felt it was on its last legs, as we saw it. When I say we, the handful of media that covered it regularly, Soccer America, and Graham Jones and a few other writers. And slowly but surely, it did come back. And the turning point ironically, was in 1984. We didn't know it at the time when soccer became a big deal at the Olympics, drew almost full capacity crowds at the Rose Bowl and in Palo Alto at Stanford Stadium. And eventually the U.S. got the World Cup bid in 1988 for 1994. And soccer, as we know it, changed. And I was elated to see, like I said, elated to see a first division back in the United States again. It was only, what, 10 teams at the time, but it was 10 teams were better than none.
That's right. Absolutely. All these wonderful players that you have seen developing into being a part of Major League Soccer, I mean, you've seen some wonderful international players come to Giant Stadium since those days at Pele and Roberto Carlos and Canalia, Werner Roth were basically, you know, dancing, scoring, celebrating, anything and everything they were able to do back in the NESL days. What was it like to see, not just to see, you know, these national team players finally competing against each other, you know, like Kobe Jones with the LA Galaxy, Tab Ramos, Tony Miola with the Metro Stars, John Harkes with DC United, Marcelo Balboa with the Colorado Rapids, and of course Alexi Lalas with the New England Revolution. What was it about finally seeing these players? They're obviously still great friends, but now they're competing against each other in a first division league.
And these players were competitors. I mean, again, they might have been, you know, roommates, perhaps friends on the national team, but put them on the field and, you know, they would go for the jugular. And I don't mean that in a nasty killing sense, but they were competitors. It was almost like they had a different personality, which was good to see. I mean, I enjoyed the way these players played, whether it was for the national team or for their club sides. And, you know, it was a lot more fun, I think, because there were more Americans in the league. I liked the fact that more Americans were getting a chance to develop at that time. And granted, there was a number of busts, as there will always be. But, you know, seeing Alexi maybe do something a little different or special for New England, Tony Miola make an important save for the Metro Stars, John Harkes helping Marco Echeverri control the DC United midfield, Tab Ramos, who this is how much confidence Tab Ramos had in his abilities. I remember one time he's playing on the right side and, you know, he loses the ball and he goes back and wins it. And instead of trying to pass off to a teammate, it was almost like he wanted to prove to the opposition, I'm going to get through you this time. And he did. Now, did he score a goal on that sequence? Probably didn't, because I would have said that he, you know, either set someone up or he scored. But he had so much confidence in his abilities, and it wasn't, and I'm telling you this, it wasn't cockiness, but it was confidence. And I just wish there'd be more American players today that would have that confidence to do that. But you know, it was great to see all these players get an opportunity to play in a league in this country. Back in the NASL, the problem was they had Americanization, where at one time they needed one player. Each team needed one player on the field. Then they raised it to two, then three, then four. Very rarely did you have an American star on the team. In MLS, every team seemed to have at least one American star, if not more. And that was gratifying to me because I thought that was going to help develop the national team and soccer in general in this country.
When Columbus created the first MLS soccer-specific stadium from Lamar Hunt, what did you write about that? Or what was important to you to see that moment happened where, okay, this is the first phase of getting out of the NFL stadiums. This is the first phase of getting out of those college football stadiums. What did you see on that one?
I said it was a start, and I said that without visiting the place yet, and that happened probably actually later in 1999, after it opened. I was at the the Lamar Hunt U.S. Open Cup final between Rochester and the Colorado Bids, which Rochester won 3-1, if my memory is correct. And I said, hey, this is great. This is great to see. And there was room enough in the press box for people. But as I kept on going back there, you kind of got the feeling that, this was more like a prototype. Things have to be better. And as much as it was a soccer-specific stadium and it was something special, but obviously we all know the nickname of the place, the Erector Set, because of the way it looked and the way it was built. But, it was a start. You needed someone to take that bold first step. And obviously after that, there were several others other new stadiums that, Home Depot Center, I don't even know what it's called anymore. I don't know how many names it's gone through, but StubHub Center or whatever it's called right now, the home of the LA Galaxy in Carson, California. Columbus Crew Stadium was a start. And I know there's going to be a new one built downtown. Part of me will be sad to see the old one go. And part of me will be hoping that this new one will be, I'm going to say, as good as Red Bull Arena, because tonight I just finished a piece. I'm doing a series of stories about different press passes I've had through the years, and I wrote about the opening of Red Bull Arena, and I said in the story, Red Bull Arena is my favorite stadium because the atmosphere and the environment, it's even without fans, it's got a great environment. Well, if the new Columbus Stadium could have half the environment of Red Bull Arena, I'll be very, very happy.
Sorry for the long-winded answer. No, please. This is fun for me. This is great because, you've seen so many moments, great moments, and at the same time, some bad moments. But, when you're traveling, you went to – obviously, you probably went to France for the 98 World Cup, and then, that was a disaster. 2002 in South Korea and Japan, that must have been a wonderful moment for you to travel, to try out some new cuisine and, besides, what goes on in Manhattan and Long Island, with all these Korean restaurants and stuff and the delicacies. And then, of course, there was South Africa in 2010, and then there was Brazil in 2014. You must have really seen a lot of interesting moments, not just on the pitch but off the pitch. Out of all the World Cups you've been to, outside of 1994, which one was the best, whether it was by a certain match or just the feeling of this team can surprise people and they could have gone all the way?
Well, the best World Cup I think I ever had, reporting-wise, and that included on and off the field too, because there were Philip Bondi, and Philip Bondi and I were with the New York Daily News. Mark Starr was the sports editor of Newsweek. We shared an apartment in Paris. That was our headquarters. And we'd be going all over the place, whether it was covering the U.S. or teams around France. And France has a marvelous train system. And I covered the usual 17 or 20 games there. Again, a lot younger version of Michael Lewis could handle it. I probably pushed it to the limit. But I had a whale of a time covering the World Cup then. Even though the U.S. was 3 and out and they were god awful, but that has nothing to do with my enjoyment of the World Cup. I have some incredible stories. I might have told you this one time, but hotel in Marseille, even though I had a voucher, they said there was no room for me, and I wound up, this is after the famous Brazil-Norway game I covered at the stadium. That was when the phantom penalty kick call, supposedly. But for S.E. Barmahas, the U.S. Referee, well, I wound up sleeping in the a hotel lobby. I negotiated that with the hotel, even though, again, I had a voucher that said I was supposed to stay there. And then I had to get up the next day, take a train up to Paris, and then switch on another train to go to Nantes to cover the U.S. in its final game. And what I decided, even though I didn't have much time between trains, I figured out I could pull this off. I went back to my apartment. Philip and Mark were out to lunch, having lunch at that moment. I redid my bag, took a quick shower because I must have, Lord knows how I smelled, and went back to another train station and caught a train, a TGV for Nantes. And when I told Mark and Philip about what I did, and they said, "You have to be kidding me," because we were only gone for about 45 minutes, and I was nicknamed the Wind because I never moved so fast in my life. And the proof was I dumped all my dirty clothes on my bed to that was my proof that I was here. I told them, "Take a look what's on my bed," and I thought it was a triumph for me. Yeah, it was a disaster for the U.S., but it was part of that. That was something special about that World Cup. Again, had nothing, yes, there was some crazy stuff happening. We all know what happened in the final with Ronaldo's mysterious ailment that knocked him out, and France winning, and Georgiev helping set up one of France's goals, and two of the French players on the field that night winding up playing in New York one day for the Yuri for the MetroStars/Red Bulls and Thierry Henry for the Red Bulls. I mean, who would have guessed that or predicted that? Looking back at it, it even makes maybe the tournament even more special for me, but I had a great time. Probably wore myself out, but I had a great time.
So, out of all the players that you've covered, American and international, which American player dazzled you the most? And it doesn't have to be, whoever played for the MetroStars/New York Red Bulls. It could be somebody else. Which American player, just gave you pause that you couldn't believe what you're watching? And which international player also did the same thing for you?
Boy. Ah, boy. This is a toughie because I can make a list of U.S. players. And I will make a list. I mean, when Landon Donovan matured, he wouldn't maybe razzle-dazzle you, but he would start putting in these consistent performances, whether it was for his club team or the national team. And when I say consistent, I'm talking about a high-quality consistency. Whether it was scoring goals or setting them up. But, for a short time, and unfortunately this is a short time, Clint Mathis did things that no American player did, particularly in MLS, and also for the national team. I mean, he's still the only player in MLS history, American, foreign-born, anyone from Mars, who scored 5 goals in a game. You have to remember that 60-70-yard jaunt against Dallas in the spring of in late April 2001. And then a week later, he scores a hat-trick against Kansas City with his left foot, right foot, and header. And then, unfortunately, he gets a knee injury, And even though he comes back in time for the World Cup and scores this highly fine clinical goal against Korea to give the U.S. an important draw, he was never really the same player as he was. If we're now going to talk about, obviously, today's generation, we're talking about Christian Pulisic, who he's still coming into his own. We're looking for the great American hope again. Hopefully, he is it. I mean, you could see what he does on the field, but as we all know in soccer, you can't just have one person to do it. You need other players around them to make them look better, because he's going to make his teammates look better. But those are, I think, three American players that come to mind. Foreign players? Oh, boy. You got me on this. You know, I saw Pelé at the tail end of his career, saw his first season in 1975, and you could tell how much pep he still had and how much better he was than many of the players. By 1977, he was a shell of his former self near the end of the season. You can just tell, unfortunately. But he helped revolutionize soccer in this country, no doubt about it. If we're talking about another foreign-born player, a Cosmos, Giorgio Canaglia, who could put the balls, into the back of the net by the bucketful. Maybe he wasn't an incredible dribbler, but man, did he have a nose for the goal! And that's the bottom line of this game. In terms of other foreign players, Valderrama of Tampa Bay, just he could stand at midfield all day and just feed his teammates, and particularly Roy Lassiter, I remember this, threw balls all the time, because he knew if you had the right weighted ball or the right player running after it, he could cause dangerous situation after dangerous situation. David Villa, when he joined the NYCFC, but he still had plenty in his tank. And he really impressed me because I said he's a blue-collar player who's earning white-collar wages, but he earned it, no doubt about it. I'm sorry if I didn't answer your question directly. I had a few players on for American and foreigners, but that's the best I could answer it now. I'll probably think of another player or two after we hang up.
No, listen, that's fine. Whatever you think is best. So let me ask you this. When we're spoiled, because when Thierry Henry came over from Barcelona after the 2010 World Cup was over with, just to watch him for 4.5 years at Red Bull Arena, what was it about Henry that bedazzled you, and how he's able to create these wonderful moments of brilliance every single time he was on the pitch at Red Bull Arena? I mean, there's the Olympico goal. There's been that, of course, the horrible 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a very humid July afternoon to see him score that goal that just delicately hits the post and in past Sean Johnson. I mean, what's about Henry that just makes you, makes your jaw drop?
It's a combination of things. As I talked about Tab Ramos just having so much talent, Henri has and the same thing. He's got talent and a very high soccer IQ. And, some of that's naturally there, and a lot of it, I think, is developed over time, just seeing space. Sometimes it's just seeing space that other people don't see, or having the confidence that you could do something like that. When Henri joined the Red Bulls in 2010, he had a lot more speed than the player in 2014. And then you could actually tell near the end, what made Henri so lethal was the fact that he could, it seemed like from without a running start, boom, he was out of the blocks. and he could do so much with the ball, and he could pass the ball. He wasn't a ball hog. He could do so many things. Let's face it, and I don't have his age in front of me, but he's getting on in years near the end of his career, or probably, what, 36, 37, I'm guessing now. And he wasn't the same player, and he knew it too. But he decided to become more of a feeder in his later years with the Red Bulls, particularly in 2014. Nothing wrong about that. I think sometimes the greatest strength of a player in any sport is that he or she knows their weakness. And he knew what his weakness was. It wasn't like he could burst out of the blocks like he did all the time. Maybe once in a while, but he'd probably have to save it too. But I think, again, that high soccer IQ, and you can't measure it. It's not like you could take an IQ test, a regular IQ test, and get a great grade. No, this is something that's just up there. You measure it by just watching a player play and appreciating what he or she can do on the field. And I think that's what made Henri such a special player. I wish he would have been a lot nicer to the media here in the New York, New Jersey area. But as they say in France, c'est la vie.
I think you have to ask the right questions to have Henri on your side. So,
yeah,
I tried to be like that myself when he was here, and you try not to give him the stupid questions. So, I mean, he was just unbelievable when he was playing here at MLS. It was just wonderful to watch.
It's funny though.
Now,
it's funny go on,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. No, I want you to go ahead.
Oh, one last, it's funny, and I know they have different backgrounds, different personalities, but speaking of 1998 World Cup winners, Yuri Gurkiev, totally different personality. He would laugh at his own jokes. He had such a light, outgoing personality. Yes, he could be peeved like anyone else, but... And I thought it was pretty cool. We all laugh at our own jokes. And to me, he was a regular person, and you could talk to him maybe off the record, but he wouldn't. I don't recall him saying that's a stupid question or why are you asking me that question. I think he would deal with it differently. Different personality, like I said. I just wanted to throw that in there if we're talking about World Cup winners who've played for the Metro Stars who played for France.
Yeah, definitely. No, you're fine. It's good. It's good. I'm glad we were able to talk about this. So a little birdie told me, you know him and I know him. His first name starts with a K and his last name starts with a D. You are writing a book about the Rochester Lancers. When did you start writing about this book, or when did you start developing this book? And how has it been so far? Has it been completed yet?
That guy KD is not my agent, by the way. If he's looking for a percentage of it, he's not going to get any. Seriously. I probably started it. I wanted to write it when I was in Rochester so many years ago. But, life gets in the way. And I've written some other books since then that made money. And I've been really pursuing big time. Easier to find information, particularly about the early years that I didn't cover the team. It's getting there, and if there's for myself, if there's one good thing about this pandemic, is I've had more time in my house to actually write the friggin' book. I didn't curse. I used a different F word there. And when I say write it, I've closed up but two chapters in the last couple of weeks, and I'm looking to close up a couple more. And I understand things are going to be opening up again and whatnot, but I got a strange feeling. I hate to say this, soccer fans, at least the ones in the New York area, maybe the rest of the country, I don't think there's going to be too much. I fear there will not be too much soccer at either Red Bull Arena or Yankee Stadium this summer, so it might give me a little more time to finish the book, because I was hoping to finish it this year. It's been a lot of fun. I still read some of the chapters, and I just shake my head saying, I can't believe this stuff happened. Some of it I covered, some of it I didn't. I've done interviews with players throughout the years on the team. My coverage, the years that I covered it, 1975 through 80, it's a lot easier to write because I saved all my clips. And I've got some interesting stories in those chapters. But the early years, crazy plane rides, players getting their entire salary for the game or the week fined, coaches getting fired left and right. I like to think I have a vivid imagination, and there's no way I could have thought this stuff up. Saying that, this team was owned by some passionate owners who might not have had the deep pockets of the Cosmos owners, Warner Communications, or Red Bull, of Red Bull, but their passion for the sport was second to none, and they kept this dream alive for 14 years. And it's the book is about love for the game, great players, some not so great players, craziness. In a lot of ways, it's what probably the early days of soccer was like for many teams in this country, whether it was in the American Soccer League or the North American Soccer League. Because I remember doing some unusual stories about some teams out in those leagues as well too. But it's I'm looking forward to finally getting this book finished. And the thing is, I keep finding more information and it gets in the way. And now I've just said, enough. Close up the chapters. If you miss something, so be it. No one's going to notice that I missed this little thing here. As long as it's factually correct and it tells the story, fine. I'm looking forward to getting it done. I think a lot of people want to see me finish it. I'm number one on the list.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't wait for you to finish it myself. It should be exciting to watch. Exciting to read. What's it like now? It's been probably 5 years now, maybe a little bit more than 5 years, that now that New York City has, I mean, oh my God, how many professional teams do we have now? So we have the New York Red Bulls, we have New York City FC, we have the New York Cosmos. Now we have a couple of other teams. One is called New Amsterdam FC in that NISA league. I guess there's another team also in the NISA league called New Jersey Teamsters, the Long Island Rough Riders, you name it. There's plethora of teams even in the lower levels in the NPSL as well. FC Motown in New Jersey, Morristown, New Jersey. You know, what does that do for you to see and hear about so many pro or semi-pro soccer teams? That do you have enough time to write about anything and everything? It's just been unreal for you.
It definitely is. You know, my first thing is I want to cover everything, and it's just impossible to do. And what I've had to do is pull back. I mean, sometimes it's better, to stay at home and do the coverage than to go to games. I know that sounds crazy, but, you can watch the Red Bulls at NYCFC on TV. And if they're away, that's not a problem at all. And you could the line to the bathroom here in the Lewis household, since we have a few bathrooms, is not too long. And it's free eats from the refrigerator, too. But on a serious note, it's great. I like the fact I love lower division soccer because there are so many great stories there from a journalist standpoint. I love seeing so many community teams. And you don't need to fill up a stadium with 50,000 people to have a strong community environment. The Kingston Stockade. In Kingston, they have a fervent fan base, among other teams. I love seeing that, and it sort of reminds me of what minor league baseball was like years ago, when it seemed like every town had its own farm team, when it was like, Class D all the way up to AAA. And granted, I understand for teams are going to come and go, and I hate to see that happen, whether it's a big team or a small-time team. but I love it. And in terms of sometimes I feel like we're all locked at a candy store. And when I say that is all we, talking about fans and media, and sometimes we don't know where to begin. And I understand it's always you're going to do the top tier first, but there's just so much out there. And sometimes you just can't get to all the candy because one, you're either your teeth, you're going to get a toothache and your teeth are going to fall out, or you're going to get a stomach ache from eating all that. Probably could never get a stomach ache from watching soccer, but I think you know what I mean. But saying that, it's great. And thumbs up for me. I just, I'd love to see soccer get more of a hold in this country.
Me too. Michael, thank you very much for your time. I really do appreciate it. Good luck with the book. Hopefully it'll be a success. And, hopefully there will be some soccer. I cannot wait to see you again. I know we'll stay in touch through the phone and stuff, but it's always a pleasure for me to be in the same room with you because, you know, to me, you are royalty when it comes to writing about the sport. I know we've met in the past before I even started to earn a press credential, but still, though, it's always an honor to be in the same room with you. Thank you very much. I hope you have a good evening. Be safe tonight, and thank you once again for coming on.
Thank you for having me on. And by the way, after I take a little break after this phone call, I am going to be working on one of the chapters of the book. I hope to be closing that chapter up, if probably not tonight, but sometime soon. So I told Joy that a little later than planned.
Well, thank you once again. Good luck with the book, and I'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, too. Have a good one. Stay safe.
I will. You, too. Thank you very much. Michael Lewis, frontrowsoccer.com. He's been covering this sport for a lot longer than 25 years, obviously. But still, though, 25 years of Major League Soccer, the men's national team, American soccer, the women's national team, everything you want to know. Thank you once again to Michael Lewis for coming on the show. A little past the hour, but that's okay, and you'll probably listen to it on the archive recorded. Thank you very much once again. This is Daniel Feuerstein, the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. Please be careful. Please be safe tonight through this whole pandemic. Please be safe and do not get involved with these rioting, the rioters and the looters. We have to remain vigilant, and we must protest peacefully through this whole situation. As always, please enjoy your football. You have a good night. Take care. So long, and bye-bye for now.